And welcome back to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dan Saunders, and we have a great discussion coming up today with Michelle Boggs from Classy, and we're going to go through their fantastic report, which attempts to dive into the foundational question about why America gives. We're going to talk about the findings from the study, but as importantly, we're going to talk about some actionable advice which nonprofits can take from the report and put into action to help improve their programs. And we're thrilled to welcome Michelle into the program right now. Michelle, you are executive nonprofit industry advisor for Classy, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. It's great to be here. I was looking at all of the episodes that you've done and feel honored to be a part of so many wonderful guests, so many awesome discussion topics. So really just grateful to be here today, excited about the conversation.
Well, we're grateful for you taking the time, and we're big fans of Classy. I've gotten to know a lot about Classy over the years from going to conferences like the NEO Summit, and you always have so much great original research to share with the industry. And it's an honor to have you on the show today to talk about this report, because I think it's really foundational to fundraising. And it also helps give fundraisers a sense of direction about some things they could be doing better to help appeal to the reasons why donors give. So we appreciate you taking the time to join us today. And before we get into the details of why America gives, we'd like to learn a little bit about our guests, how you got into this industry, your backstory. So if you wouldn't mind, could you kind of take us how you got into the industry, where you are today, and then share a little bit about Classy for any listeners that may not be aware of your work?
Sure. So I think, like so many of your guests, I would venture to say, I sort of stumbled into the nonprofit industry. I was going to do sales, or I did sales for a little while right out of college. And then my mom actually ended up having a very massive heart attack at a very young age. And so we became volunteers of the American Heart Association as sort of a way to learn more about navigating through this terrible thing that happened to her that was so unexpected and had really changed our lives. So we became volunteers. And then, like some volunteers at nonprofits, somehow you become staff. So I, my first like real job was with the American Heart and Stroke Association. And I was there for almost 15 years. It was an amazing career. I got to wear lots of different hats and got to really touch every aspect of this world, you know, high net worth donors, corporate partners, fundraising in schools, grants, I mean, everything you can think of. And then I went on to work at a children's hospital, which was a really special job. I have four kids of my own, and just to see what some of these families would go through, it was an amazing, amazing job. And then I was with Leukemia and Lymphoma Society for a bit before finding my way to Classy. What I will say is, I think what makes this work so special is you get to work with some of the most intelligent, dynamic, generous, creative people in the world in this really special way. You know, you're not a board member or an employee. You get to help them really live out their vision and their legacy. So I think it's really special work. And it's been an honor to have done it these last 20 years. And Classy, I was actually a customer of, not once, but twice, which makes this role really cool and I think perfectly suited for me. So I've worked in nonprofits where we didn't know how to harness the data that we had to make decisions. We didn't know how to reach donors online, and Classy really helped us do that. Classy is a giving platform, and we believe in enabling nonprofits to connect with supporters that care about their cause. And we are on a mission to mobilize and empower the world for good. We talk about internally, our vision is to be the most helpful company in the world. Classy is obsessed with the success of our customers, and I can really vouch for that as a customer. What really set Classy apart for me was this dedication and support that we got from the team to make sure whatever we were doing was successful. And if we hit bumps in the road, how could we strategize together to work through those? At our core, Classy believes that fundraising should be easy, that giving online should be just as easy as placing a drink order at Starbucks. And so we focus on a lot of different things in the online giving world: direct giving, main donation pages, peer-to-peer, crowdfunding, recurring giving. We're headquartered in San Diego, and we serve over 6,000 nonprofits.
Incredible. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing your personal story. I think that's what's so great about the sector is we do have so many dynamic, creative individuals who come from so many different backgrounds. But when you combine that with a real personal attachment to an issue because of a personal experience, I think it really is kind of the secret sauce about what makes this sector special. So thank you for sharing your story with us. And thank you for all of the great work that you've done in the industry over the years and for your continued work here with Classy. And as we get into the report, I want to start with a couple of lines that I noted from the very first page, which I think kind of sets up an overview for it very well. And I'll read it here for our audience, and we will drop a link to the report in the show notes. So if you want to kind of go through the report with us, I definitely recommend it to read cover to cover because it's all very valuable, even if it's outside of this interview. But this line really caught my attention. Americans' view of giving has evolved to include donating to established nonprofits, as well as giving directly to individuals or causes in need, and providing non-monetary contributions, such as volunteering time. Many donors are passionate about making an impact, but find it challenging to identify an organization that matches their values. And I thought that was so important because we hear so much about the number of donors which have decreased over the last couple of decades. And sometimes there's thought about there is a generosity crisis out there or people just not giving. But I think what this cues up is that people are still inherently generous. They want to give back. Is the issue that maybe we're not creating enough avenues to give donors ways to get involved, to give back to organizations? And from your work on the study, what more do you think we could be doing to create outlets for donors or even just supporters who are passionate about a cause to get involved with nonprofits and to give back with their passion?
Yeah, that's so much to unpack there. And I think about that all the time. I just did an internal presentation to a Classy team around some of the trends to pay attention to. And, you know, it's worrying to see that this 10-year trend has continued even last year of amount of gifts decreasing, size of gifts increasing. And what is the why behind that? I think you hit on a lot of things. I think what we're seeing at Classy and we're hearing from our nonprofit customers is like, this, we have to have this ability to cut through the noise. I mean, people's attention spans are so short. The minute that they feel this passion or this drive, you know, to want to do something, we have to be able to capture that momentum. And, you know, we don't do that when someone goes to a donations or an organization's webpage and they have to get a credit card or they have to figure out how to give, or maybe some of the donation amounts are outside of their scope. If your entry-level gift is $30, I can tell you, you are turning off a lot of donors. So is it easy to give? Are there flexible payment options? Trust is a big thing, Dan. Like, you hear that a lot, you know, trust continues to erode in nonprofit. So when they go to your website to validate your mission and your impact, is that easy to access, that information? Can they see your financials? Do they feel like when they make a payment, it's secure on their website? So I think, you know, and it's just such a competitive landscape. You know, every donor is being approached by so many nonprofits. So how do you really have strong and powerful storytelling that not only moves them to give, but are you then thanking and stewarding and starting to build out, like you say on your podcast, that concept of that 360 degree approach? I just don't think we do that well as an industry. So I think it's great the work that you're doing and the conversations that you're having, because I think this is a real time for us to turn that trend around, because I think people are more generous than ever. That's what the report is telling us. It's just, how do we unlock that generosity and have people feeling good about their giving? At the end of the day, it should be fun and it should feel awesome. And it's no more complicated than that.
Well, thank you for the kind words. And I do agree that the concept of unsiloed fundraising plays into a lot of what you're talking about there, just in those opening paragraphs. And that's, you know, if somebody does volunteer, and, you know, we have to remember, and I live every day in the world of direct mail fundraising. So, you know, certainly the revenue, the cash flow for organizations, it is donor centric. And of course, you know, mid-level major donor, it's important just for helping to grow organizations, but it's very easy to kind of get lost into what is the journey like to somebody who maybe can't contribute at all, but wants to volunteer, or maybe is just an online advocate and shares information about your cause or your organization. Do you make them feel appreciated? And what kind of job are we doing to get these supporters into the pipeline, at least engage in the organization where they feel heard, they feel appreciated, they feel valued, because life changes very quickly. And it feels like just the other day we were talking about millennials as, you know, a group of broke college kids, right? And now millennials are, you know, they're in their prime earning years, they are owning homes, they have families of their own. So things change very quickly. And how do you create that pipeline for that grassroots enthusiasm for people who may only be able to contribute a small amount that's still meaningful to them, or get involved in other ways? And we talk so much about donor gratitude. And I don't want to pretend like we all do a great job with expressing gratitude towards our donors, but do we talk a lot about supporter or activist gratitude and making them feel included in the cause, even if they can't monetarily contribute? So I really appreciated the opening lines there. And it really was kind of a refreshing and inspiring reminder that there is a lot of the impulse to be generous is still very strong. Maybe we just have to find a better way to connect with people who are on the fringes of giving, or maybe even outside of giving at this moment, but still have lots of enthusiasm and passion for these great causes.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one of the things you said that really stuck with me is, like, you know, we continue to deal with attrition in this industry. I mean, the numbers are crazy, and it's so tough for a nonprofit because you continue to have to do more with less. And then you add turnover in there, especially when it comes to like major gifts. You know, it might take 2 or 3 years to build a relationship with a donor. And then if that major gift officer leaves, you're starting from scratch. But I think we have a real responsibility, like you said, to take everyone within our network as a nonprofit. So folks coming to our events to volunteer, folks giving in kind, folks just spreading our message on, you know, a social media page. How do we make them feel the love? Because we know that down the line, they may become a transformational donor for us. I had read a study recently, and it was a survey of $1 million plus donors to organizations. And on average, the $1 million gift was their 17th gift. And the first gift on average was $100. And it goes back to technology. Like, that's why I was so excited to come to Classy, because the answer is technology. You know, we have the donor data in front of us. We have easy turnkey ways to communicate that take very little human effort if we can harness technology that can develop these donor stewardship plans, whether, again, they just came to an event and gave a couple hours of their time. Now we've got them involved, and we've got a path to keep them engaged and involved, to turn them from that passive one-off donor to a loyal donor, to really make a dent in those terrible attrition numbers. I think the key to all of that is technology. And that's, yeah, I think, so exciting about all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the people who are giving. One of the interesting things that I found in the study is that you break out donors into two different groups, passive and loyal. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between those two categories of donors, and why separate donors into those two buckets when looking at their motivations?
Yeah. And I think first I'll answer the second question is like, we wanted to break them out because we know we wanted it to come across that we know you have to take care of your loyal donors. Like, hopefully you're hearing that now more than ever is like, love those closest to you, because we know the investment in finding new is so much higher than keeping the ones you have. But we also didn't want to downplay the opportunity of these passive donors. So we defined loyal donors in our report as a donor who's contributed to the same organization at least 3 times over the past 5 years. Or these are folks just continuing to make recurring donations year over year, like a subscription type, membership type model. Passive donors, on the other hand, are donors who've contributed through sort of one-off donations and have not shown a consistent pattern of donating within those 5 years. So like I said, we've always known that loyal donors are really, really important. But the findings through this report have shown us just how valuable they really are when it comes to like that consistent funding that allows you to project and plan and budget. This year, loyal donors, the ones that responded to the report, are twice as likely to increase their donations this year compared to passive. And on average, will give 4 times the amount as a passive donor. They're also more open to supporting various causes rather than just causes they've supported in the past. So this really stuck out to me because I can't tell you how many development teams I've been a part of where you're talking about a donor and it's like, oh, Dan, he only gives to this organization. And it was always like, don't answer for them. Like, let's give them the opportunity to learn about us and make that decision. So not being assumptive. So we can't discount these passive donors. They're more likely to give directly to an individual who needs direct assistance. And when they do, they're about 60 times likely to do research after they learn about this organization. So imagine the impact we could have if we removed this friction of donors feeling like they need to go and validate and research and all of that. So Classy has been spending a lot of time digging into this. And for listeners who don't know, GoFundMe acquired Classy last year. And the power of these two organizations is really centered around some of that passive donor work. So we've launched a program, a pilot program, where essentially if a donor on GoFundMe gives to an individual in need, let's use blood cancer as an example. So I gave to my friend, Dan, who's dealing with blood cancer, and I want to support his family because he has increased medical bills. Through this pilot with Classy and GoFundMe, as folks are giving to Dan on the GoFundMe platform, they'll be introduced during the giving prompts, they'll be introduced to other charities and nonprofits who are doing similar work. So it's kind of eliminating that need to research and find organizations that care about the same causes. So as the person's going through the prompts on the GoFundMe platform, it'll say, hey, you care about blood cancer. Did you know these 3 organizations in your region are doing great work? Would you like to learn more? So it's you know, introducing these 100 million plus activated individuals on the GoFundMe platform with all the nonprofits out there trying to do similar work and trying to have similar impact. So the idea of passive and loyal is very important to Classy and should be very, very important thing to pay attention to if you're sitting, you know, in the nonprofit world right now.
Right. Well, the immediate question is, what can we do to get passive donors to become loyal donors? What's that gap that we could help fill into them? So I think it's important to look at them individually, as you did. I love the definition that you used for loyal donors, though, because a lot of organizations may not assume that somebody who gives 3 times within 5 years is a loyal donor. And within that, it's very easy that somebody could lapse over a 12-month period and then in our mind, we put them into this bucket as being a lapsed donor, but it's important to look at multi-year activity because that is a pretty strong record, 3 contributions in 5 years. And if somebody does miss a donation in a given year, maybe there's a way to approach them that's different from how you would approach a traditional lapsed donor. So I think that's healthy. It's a healthy mindset that somebody doesn't necessarily have to give to you every year or within the last 6 or 12 months to be treated as a loyal donor, and that they do have a lot of value to them. So I think that's a really important distinction that you made. And any thoughts from your findings about ways that we can help bridge the gap with people who are giving one-off gifts? What is the sector not doing that we could be to help build those connections?
Yeah, I think a big thing just centers around, you know, what does that post-gift relationship look like with that donor? You know, are you taking the time? And maybe we'll talk about this later, Dan, is one of the other key findings in the report is all around the generational divide. So like segmenting your donors by age, and there's really important information there. So when a passive one-off donor gives, you know, are you first getting to the bottom of why they gave? Some of the big reasons we saw these passive donors give is that there was a recent increase in their donor passion. There was a recent increase in need for donation, and there was a recent increase in your cause's relevance. So connecting those dots is really important. And I think also, not to sound opportunistic, but I think also, you know, there are all these things happening in the world and people are going to feel activated by them. How do you align your nonprofit to take advantage of some of those things happening? You know, you talked about the Damar Hamlin craziness that happened in one of your episodes. That's the perfect example of like, are you even being strategic to captivate these passive donors? If big things are happening in the world around climate or the war in Ukraine or the baby formula shortage, are you tying any of that back to your mission and what you're trying to solve for? So I think it's, you know, just meeting them where they are, understanding, you know, why they were called to action in that moment, why there's now relevance to your cause. And then after the gift, what does that communication look like? Are you reaching them on social where they want to be reached? Are you sending long, lengthy emails that maybe a younger person's not going to read and not going to feel inspired by? So every time you reach out, are you asking for another gift or are you just sharing impact? Are you inviting them to events? So I think it's just, you know, being critical and figuring out like, how am I treating this passive donor? Am I treating them as though I'm going to do everything it takes to turn them into a loyal donor? And just having that honest dialogue on your teams of, am I doing a good job with this? I know I didn't in probably every organization I worked at, especially around like Giving Tuesday, year-end giving, like some of that stuff you just took for granted. Just to be vulnerable with you, you know, did I sit down in January and look and say, okay, what can I do for these 37 people who gave a one-off gift and haven't given to us in over 5 years? Or to your point, maybe someone hasn't given for 2 years, but gave 5 years before that. And I've written them off, you know, oh, they're not interested in us anymore. They've moved on. So I think it's just, again, it's like digging into the data, right? It's just all about that.
Absolutely. And I find it interesting that you talked about the experience when they first give. And I think that's such an important point that the way that donors get thanked and acknowledged can go a long way to determining how loyal they remain to the organization, how valuable they become, whether they maximize their potential value in the relationship with the organization. I think it's not impossible to bridge that gap after the fact, but I think it's you're most likely to bridge that gap in the immediacy of the contribution. And what's exciting about that is I think there's a lot of very low-hanging solutions that are out there to do that. You know, are you sending donors a receipt? Or are you sending them a thank you with a story about the impact their gift is going to make? Maybe this is my direct mail bias coming through, but a lot of digital first organizations do not thank in the mail. I think it's a big mistake to assume that online donors do not want to be thanked in the mail. Whether we get into the discussion of whether you should be asking for donations in the mail and have a direct mail program, to thank them in the mail is a very different experience than through email. I just believe they have more attention to it. And it's a little bit more meaningful, perhaps, because it is still a unique experience getting a meaningful thank you in the mail. Are you asking for phone numbers or doing phone thank yous? I think what's so powerful about phone thank yous is if you make it clear that you're just calling to say thanks, that's powerful in itself, but it gives the opportunity to do exactly what you're saying. And hey, what brought you to our organization today? And use getting actual intelligence from donors in a nuanced way. I think online surveys can be helpful for this, but when you speak to somebody over the phone, you get those little nuances about their passions and what, you know, the path that they took to come to you. And most donors, I think, are perfectly willing to share that. They're just not often asked for it. So there is a lot we can do just on the gratitude front to help address some of these things. And I think that's what's exciting is there's none of these things require massive amounts of technology or massive amounts of investment. It really kind of gets back to the fundamentals of fundraising and how are we thanking a donor when they come into our organization.
Yeah, and I think what's could solve for maybe another challenge and like sort of kill two birds with one stone is like, as you start to navigate through the WAG report and you look at some of this actionable stuff, where my mind goes is who on your team can you sort of empower to own this? You know, you look at our industry, the turnover rates are bad, folks are leaving. And a lot of the reasons are, you know, not a lot of opportunities for growth, better pay, things like that. But how can you take some of these challenges and empower folks on your team to solve for them? You know, it's a special project, or, you know, they need to put together a cohort or a group to work on this. So we need to revamp what our cultivation and stewardship looks like specifically for this subset of donors, or we need a creative approach to XYZ. You've got amazing people on your team. Talk about an opportunity to engage your employees, give them, you know, stretch projects that might make them feel good about the work that they're doing, take them out of their day-to-day scope. That's where we saw a lot of success in teams that I've worked on, where some of the best ideas came out around, hey, what if we just sent a short little video made on our iPhone? People love that. The more authentic stuff rather than this expensive edited video. So I think, you know, don't forget also that the folks on your team can help solve for some of this stuff and feel kind of re-inspired by their work. You know, you've got this information. Now, what do we do about it?
Yeah. And to bridge a previous part of this conversation, a lot of those opportunities, I think, come up when you do start to break down the walls between donor development and donor communication. So the donor communication folks often have a lot of these ideas and they understand how to engage with donors. And when they're brought into the conversation and say, hey, what can we do that would be meaningful, that'll get a positive response to donors? I mean, something as simple as that, right? An iPhone video, thank you. Very powerful, very meaningful, authentic. Not a big technological lift, and something that's certainly, you know, doable for the smallest of organizations. So that's a great anecdote. I did want to move into some of the information that you had here that you spoke to donors about the economy, because I think it breaks down some excuses. Quite frankly, it's very easy to kind of look at the economy, look at inflation, and say, well, this is the reason donors aren't giving. Your data pokes some holes in that. And I think this is very important because it does drive through, going back to our last conversation, that there's a lot that's within your control that you can do to address donor retention and donor lifetime value, even in with all these economic headwinds that we're all dealing with. And this is on page 5 for anybody who's watching along, reading along with us. 49% of donors we spoke to shared a pessimistic view of the economy. 77% made changes to their lifestyle, financial changes to their lifestyle in 2022. That certainly adds up with, I think, all of our everyday experiences. But 90% plan to donate more, the same or more in 2022 than last year. And that is amazing to me that even in the face of all these headwinds and needing to make changes at the grocery store and all the things that pretty much everyone has had to navigate over the last couple of years, people are still inclined to be generous and want to increase or at least sustain their level of giving. How do you square those two things?
Yeah, I was really like pleasantly shocked to read that. Like we kind of talked about in the beginning, I think there is this resounding message of positivity in the report, which is super cool, just given sort of this, you know, time that we're in. So donors are showing resiliency for sure. We saw that people will review their spending habits. They will adjust accordingly. They'll delay unnecessary spending and make reductions. Through the survey, we saw that people are actually categorizing their charitable giving in that second bucket of what they would consider critical spend. And we saw this during the early days of COVID as well. And I think the reason for it is in the last couple of years, people, like more than ever, have seen, they're just so much more cognizant of increased societal needs. It's like, we can't unsee what we've seen over the last few years of how much disparity there is, how much suffering there is in the world. We've got huge challenges ahead of us to tackle as a society. And so I think it goes back to, you look at like voter turnout rates at the midterm elections, you look at things like that. People want to be activated. They want to be generous. They want to do good. It goes back to us making it as easy as possible to do it. And I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but it's those things like, in that moment, I want to give to you. Are you making it easy? Or are you making me get up and go track down my credit card? If I'm ready to give $5 in that moment, because that's what I've budgeted, am I able to do that? Or are you setting me up to give at 20 or 30 and now I can't do it? Mm-hmm. Are you making it easy for, maybe I can only give five, but I've got a huge network of friends that I want to share this with. Are you making it easy for me to galvanize my network and get others involved? And what was interesting about the report as well is the folks who will keep their giving the same tended to be the older baby boomer donors, and the younger generations indicated in the survey that they actually had plans of giving a bit more, the same or a bit more. So I thought that was even really kind of interesting and shocking. I would have maybe played it the other way.
Right, defying generational stereotypes about giving, yeah. Which is why, yeah, this real world data is so important. In fact, 53% of donors accounted for donations when planning their financial budget. And that lies in the face of the assumption that giving is kind of lumped in with discretionary spending, that it's something that people look at after they've spent money on their essentials. And what this suggests is that no, people really do prioritize their giving. It's a meaningful part of their identity, and they're budgeting it alongside of all of their immediate needs. That in itself is encouraging. And 40% of donors, or 39%, said they made small changes and sacrificed in their daily living expenses to have funds to donate. So in some cases, four in 10, almost half of donors are actually willing to make changes to their spending habits to make sure that they can remain involved and contribute to these important causes. And I think that is just so, it's such a powerful reminder not to assume that the macroeconomic environment is predictive of how donors are going to react. Giving has always been a little bit different and has that emotional tug on it. And this really kind of drives that home, not to lean on those potential reasons for donors not to give, that there are things that you can do to close that gap. And to your point, you know, how easy are you making it to donors? How appreciated are you making them feel in the face of economic headwinds? My question is, how many organizations are acknowledging that in their thank yous, that there's so many reasons not to give today and you're choosing to? And that says so much about you as a donor. I think there's a way to take a negative and leverage it into an even greater positive. But thank you for those findings. And I was surprised by them myself, but I think it was very inspiring and a great reminder about why giving is always a little bit different than other transactional activity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in reading all of that, it just, again, hit home, like what a great then responsibility we have to make sure that that donation not only does the good that it's intended to do, but that we acknowledge the sacrifice, that we acknowledge the pre-thought that went into that, that we acknowledge, like you said, there's so much going on. There's all the reasons in the world why you could have said no, but you said yes. So I think that being authentic and vulnerable and calling that out, I think people would react so positively to that. Another thing I thought was interesting that I wanted to call out, and you just reminded me of it, was like where we see the biggest decline in gift count, this trend that we've been seeing for 10 years. Last year, the biggest decline in gift count was in the smallest level. So gifts of like $25, $50, $100. We saw double-digit increases. We saw very, very tiny decreases. I think it was like 0.04% in gifts over $50,000. So you could splice that a lot of different ways, but folks are going from giving smaller amounts to lots of organizations to maybe a little bit bigger amounts to fewer organizations. So again, it's like, it's yours to lose. It's just, how do you go out there and make people feel incredible about what they've just done and how they've just given?
Yes, I've heard anecdotes about that as well, that it was really more what we would consider to be the lower level giving that fell off last year, and not mid-level or major gifts. And I find that interesting in the face of this information that you're sharing about donor motivation. And I wonder how much of it is because we're giving up those donations too easily. We're not fighting for them as organizations and making our case for why, no, your $15, your $20 contribution, it still matters. In fact, it matters more than ever because there are so many people who aren't able to keep up with their giving. How are we making that case? And I don't know that that could completely make up for the obvious, you know, the economic difficulties that people are having. But I think it could help, and it certainly could help hold on to donors, and certainly being more gracious and making a stronger case about our missions and the impact and the importance of these smaller gifts. I think it could probably help that phenomenon of these lower dollar donors, you know, dropping out. This part here on page six, I think this one's critically important because it talks about passion and increased need to prompt generosity. And I think this connects really well to some previous points that you made about making it easy to donate, as well as leveraging the passion of donors. When donors were that plan, donors who planned to give more in 2022 were asked why, their top reasons were a recent increase in donor passion, a recent increase in the need for donations, a recent increase in the cause's relevance. Nothing in that category references a change in their own financial situation. It has to do with a passion, maybe a personal connection to a cause, a high profile need, you know, such as a natural disaster or something that's making its way into the news, or a relevance. Do you see any ways to act on this information? I think that would be the first part of my question. And then the second would be, what are some ways that we could make it easier for donors to give in that moment when the passion connects, whether it's because they see something on the news or they become aware of an increased need? How can we make it easy for them to kind of make that instantaneous decision and to give right away and not to allow time to lapse or them to become distracted by anything else?
Yeah, I think if you think about, like you said, the top three motivations had nothing to do with their own personal situation, right? It had more to do, like, in that moment, how that particular cause, organization, relevance, what it meant to them. So I think we've said this a little bit already, but I think, again, if I feel inclined to give in that moment, there's a spark, it's got to be easy. The transaction's got to be easy. classy. That's so much of what we do with our customers, is taking a look at how to boost conversion rates. You know, how long are folks staying on your page? Are they finding the information they need? Is the transaction seamless and easy? So I think so much of it is that ease of interacting with your technology. Is it a headache, or is it, you know, really user-friendly and easy to do? And then I think, again, how quickly in that moment can I share what I've just done with others? You know, can I tap into my network and say, hey, I just gave $10. Will you join me? Or look how excited I am that I've done this. This is important to me. You're hearing about it in the news. I'm doing something about it. And then I think like trying to just change your mindset within your organization of, and I hate to use the word crisis, but there's been so much discussion around this, is like, how do we proactively prepare ourselves for whatever the next big thing is? You know, is your board trained and ready to activate on, you know, a call blitz to call donors? Would you be able to do that tomorrow if there was an opportunity? Do you have spokespeople, storytellers? Do you have, you know, posts on social media ready to go? So I think it's like just thinking differently about how you approach your business, knowing that these things are, it's not a matter of when, if it's a matter of when. So how can your organization just be better prepared? You know, we're not, this industry is not known for like moving quickly on things, but again, I think with technology, we can change some of that. And a lot of it's a mindset change around what big thing could happen and how are we going to be prepared to take advantage of it, to get our message out there, to share our work. And there's so many different ways you can do that. But I think it really starts with just this mindset of, these donors are going to come to us. How do we keep them? And how do we continue to game plan around that, if that makes sense?
No, it absolutely does. And I think that should have been one of the learning points from the pandemic experience, is crisis planning and not being caught off guard by failing to imagine. And I don't think there's a limit on the types of organizations that should be crisis planning. You know, if you're raising money for a museum, I think a really, really important intellectual exercise is, what would we do if we had to close our doors tomorrow? How would we cast our mission? How would we explain this to donors? How would we communicate the need? And it shouldn't be a failure to imagine anymore, because we went through something like that, that, you know, I think most people probably did not anticipate. I agree. Crisis planning and gaming that out. How are we going to respond if our cause does have a high profile event around it, or comes into the news? What I liked about these points is that a couple of these I see as not being out of the organization's control. So increase in donor passion. Obviously, we can't control the life events that donors go through, but we can communicate the need for donations. I think we could all do a better job of doing that, about why your support makes a difference. And I think we could also increase the relevance of a cause, because what is relevance other than the relevance to an individual? And that can be either through better online content marketing or digital marketing combined with other channels, or even just good old-fashioned earned media. You know, getting an editorial published in a newspaper, and then using that editorial as an insert in a mail piece. Some of these are not outside of our control, but certainly the idea of donor passions and being able to respond in that moment and make it easier to give, really easy example from the direct mail side. And this is a conversation I have a lot, was that, I think organizations should be including QR codes in their mail pieces. There's a little bit of a debate about whether it's best to have it be an immediate call to donate, or some type of supplemental story that kind of adds a layer to the mail piece. But I think what's cool and about QR codes and the potential is, maybe working with organizations like Classy and being able to make a really easy giving experience when you go through the QR code on your phone, is there's so many reasons to put down a piece of mail. Mm-hmm. And the best time to get a donor to give what is when it's top of mind, and they could do it in a turnkey way. And that's always been a little bit of the friction with direct mail, but I think QR codes take that away. And even if most of your donations are going to come back via checks and credit cards, there are a certain number of donors who are going to put it down, get distracted by, you know, anything with their life or something that their kids need to do, and then not give. And it's just a way to kind of cut through that and give them an easy way to give in the immediacy of the moment. And I'm sure there's parallels to digital and mobile giving as well. And, you know, how easy is it for someone to give when your cause is top of mind?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so much of what you said just reminds me of, like, at its core, like, we just have to break down some of these old mental models and just continue to be open and flexible and, you know, just not be so quick to shut down ideas like the QR code. Let's give it a try. Like, I just got an invite to a webinar and I had like this visceral reaction to it around, it was like, donate now, pay later. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. But like, maybe there's something to that, you know? I mean, 10 years ago, people didn't even want to give online. They thought that was crazy. So I think just what I always try to do in the approach to my work is, again, like, not make assumptions, try to really be agile in my approach, try to think about different ways of doing things, because it's constantly changing. You know, texting is coming back, just staying abreast of your industry and always listening to your donors, I just think is the key.
And you do give some good tips here about the emotional benefits that donors get from giving, the gratitude for the work of the nonprofits do, feeling a part of a greater solution, feeling good about themselves. And it's amazing how so much of this conversation is interconnected, and so many of the findings in this report are interconnected. But again, it does go back to the power of gratitude and how you're thanking the donor and communicating these things and unleashing these good feelings in the donor when you are thanking them. So I thought that was it. You know, just another interesting just a reminder about the importance of gratitude. I did want to dig into a finding which is certainly near or dear to my heart, and that is that loyal U.S. donors build relationships through various channels. Mm-hmm. And curious to get your thoughts on this and the findings within the report. But this has always been a foundational belief of mine that every point of contact with a donor, whether or not they give through that channel, adds value and makes the relationship a little bit stickier with them. And that's difficult because so many organizations still kind of operate in siloed environments with the channels within their donors. But can you talk a little bit about that, about the importance and benefits of a multi-channel relationship with donors, regardless of how they actually give to your organization?
Yeah, I love, again, like, that's so much of what you dig into in your podcast is really that like 360 degree approach. And, you know, Classy is one piece of it. And we believe we're a really important piece of your donor relationship. But it's, I think nonprofits tend to sort of like put all their eggs in one basket. And it goes back to like resource issues, you know, doing more with less, a lot of that. But so it'll be, okay, you know, social's the big wave. We have to invest all of our marketing dollars in social, you know, and those are often really inflated, the ROI. So now we're just in the social world and we've moved away from sending anything in the mail. And now we've just alienated this whole subset of donors that liked receiving that little letter from us or whatever it was. Or maybe we're putting all of our eggs in the gaming basket because we think that's really cool. And we think our donors are going to resonate with that. But now we've moved away from, you know, a strong email campaign. So I think it's having, you know, this stretch of tentacles and reaching donors where they are in all these different ways. But taking a look and digging in of where you're getting ROI, where it makes sense. But I think it's everything. It's just that entire journey of who is my relationship at that organization from a people standpoint? How are they communicating with me? What does it look like when I show up to an event? How are they interacting with me as a donor? How are they reaching me digitally? How are they reaching me through traditional media? How are they reaching me through the mail? So I think it's just not sort of running after that one shiny object and looking at it more holistically, I think is the approach.
Yeah, and the top ways that you reference here that loyal donors said they preferred building relationships are donating through a simple donation form on an organization's website, signing up to receive communication updates, emails, texts, newsletters. I'm going to come back to that point, and volunteering on behalf of an organization. So right there, conceivably, we're talking about four or five different channels of communication with an organization. And how often do we put out a call to action to our donors to volunteer for an organization? Maybe not every donor wants to volunteer, but certainly there's a certain percentage of them. And are we even giving them that opportunity? But I love the point about communication updates. And this is where I see there is a gap, even within organizations that are practicing multi-channel fundraising, is if we have digital donors with no postal addresses, what are we doing to try to get their USPS addresses to give them a print newsletter? You've listened to the show, so you've probably heard me get on my soapbox a number of times about the power of print newsletters, only because so many nonprofits moved away from them as email was coming up. And we're learning just in the last few years just how valuable they are and how dynamic they are, with stories you could tell and ways that you could talk about other ways to give or volunteer to an organization. Just very powerful layer to add on to any relationship, regardless of how they came. Same thing with text. You know, how are we looking at our direct mail donors? Can we get a text relationship going with them to give them text updates about their impact and creating multi-layered relationships with donors? And it sounds like that's a real distinguishing characteristic with these loyal donors who are giving three times within 5 years, is they have a lot of connectivity through a lot of different ways to the organizations they support. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. And I think what you touched on is certainly loyal and passive, but I think a lot of it to me really goes back to like that generational divide. So challenging yourself as a nonprofit to your point of like, okay, we know direct mail may appeal to this age group, but if it were to appeal to this younger age group, what could that look like? Or we know that galas at our nonprofit typically appeal to 55 and older. What could it look like to engage a younger group to come to our gala? Is it a lower ticket price, you know, a cheaper entry fee? Is there a wraparound event we could do as part of the gala? So I think anything that you do, challenge yourself to ask, this has been working with this group of donors, what would it take for it to work with this other group that we're trying to reach? And maybe it's not, you know, maybe that's not the approach and you won't do it for every single thing. But I think it's just coming from that place of segmenting, realizing not every donor story is the same. Not every donor wants to be communicated the same. So I think it's just, and I know, you know, I was so guilty of this. It would be really easy to get rid of a newsletter because it costs X and it's this much manpower and blah, blah, blah. But the question could be, why, you know, what would it take to make a newsletter really be powerful and work? You know, I get one from my college and I love it. It's short. It's not, you know, super long to read. It's quick, digestible information. I feel informed as a donor of what's going on at this school that I care about. So I think it's just not making those assumptions, challenging your organization. You've got all these different channels. What would it take to get them to work for different donor profiles, whether they're passive, whether they're a Gen X, whether they're loyal, whether they're a baby boomer?
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned generational differences in the channels, because this is definitely an ongoing debate with direct mail. The average age of a donor to a nonprofit is 72 years old, and that age has been frozen in time for 4 years. So there is a certain demographic that direct mail certainly appeals to. But my question is, can we assume that the medium is the problem if we're talking to 25 and 35 year olds, like 70 year olds, or do we need a different approach, different format, different writing style? That I'm not seeing nearly enough of experimentation with, but I think it's a really promising area for all channels to remember that donors are individuals and they can be generationally different. And in this day and age when we're so used to personal communication, it's difficult to assume that everyone's going to respond to the same thing equally. And I think that's such a healthy mindset to think about. How can we do generational testing and speak to different age donors differently within the same medium? That's definitely something I would like to see more of in the mail for sure.
Yeah, a couple of the quick generational things that really stuck out to me from the Why America Gives report is these younger donors actually, what we found, want to hear from us more often. So again, like, you know, you may think three or four communications over the course of a month is too much, you know, they're going to be turned off. They're going to think we're harassing them or whatever, you know, again, mental model you've built up in your mind, but this survey is telling us they want to hear from us more often and, you know, multiple ways, multi-channel approach. Older donors may want less frequent communication, but maybe a bit lengthier, a bit more detailed, more robust. And we know that, and then there were similarities, which was interesting. So we know that both the younger and older generation, when they go to your website to validate or research or whatever it is, both of these age groups are very interested in, like you said, Dan, these volunteer opportunities. Are those easy to find? Are they even available? Or no, you know, is it an Easter egg hunt to find that? And the older generation, when they go to your website, they're going to want to see financials really easily. They want that transparency. So there's a lot of convergence and divergence among the age groups. But I agree. I think there's so much opportunity in more segmentation. To me, like, that would be a takeaway and a really actionable thing from this report within a nonprofit is like just taking a look at, okay, we had all these donors come to X event. How did we thank them? How did we communicate with them after the event? Was it exactly the same, no matter who you were, or was it a bit different? So I think there's so much to do there.
Yeah, and again, this is another instance where what donors are telling you in this report, especially younger ones, it's very different from a lot of the conventional wisdom out there that. And I get concerned whenever I hear this, that younger donors don't want to hear from nonprofits, that they don't want them to have their email address or their USPS address. And I think whenever we hear that, whether it is a younger donor or an older donor is, I think what people are really saying is I want better communication. I don't want to feel like I'm spammed. I don't want to feel like I'm just a dollar figure. But maybe looking at how can you increase the value of the communication. Michelle, we really appreciate your time and you being so generous with us. Are there any, you know, we've talked about a lot here. Is there any one or two couple of actionable takeaways that you would really like fundraisers to focus in on after going through this report?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, when I think about a couple of things that I would be really excited to go back to my team with after reading this, I think one of the big ones is, what does your website look like? You know, what is that online experience? So I got introduced to your organization from an influencer or a social media channel, or I came to your event. Now I'm going to go to your website. The WAG tells us a lot of people will go to your website. So what is that first impression? That's an easy thing. And just working with so many clients at Classy, it's been a really interesting journey of, you know, perception of an organization, and then does that match the website? So that's a really easy thing to look at, is your website meeting the needs of your donors? And then I think that segment piece, Dan, of, is it a one size fits all, or can you find more creative ways to reach passive donors, to reach baby boomers? I think that segment is something easy that you can do without a lot of heavy lift. I would say those two things.
Wonderful. Great advice. Michelle, thank you again for being so generous with your time and walking us through this great study. Download Why America Gives. We'll leave a link to it in the show notes and spend some time going through it. There's probably a lot more than we were even able to cover here. And you really will walk away with a lot of actionable takeaways to help improve your program. And definitely check out the rest of Classy's great research as well. Real quick, Michelle, best way to get in touch with you or to learn more about Classy for anyone who would like to learn more?
Yeah, thanks so much, Dan. Check out Classy's website. We have so many free resources, an amazing blog, lots of toolkits, really anything you could think of. I would also throw out there a shameless plug. We just launched this week. Our collaborative conference is back in Philly in June. So check that out. It's an amazing conference. I am on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. Would love to connect with any listeners there. And Dan, just congratulations. I was looking, I'm thinking like your 4-year anniversary is going to be close to like your 100th episode. Is that accurate? I just think it's amazing. And congrats on all the great work that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. This is very kind. And it's been a lot of fun. And honestly, the best part has been connecting with so many great fundraisers. And there's just so many dynamic minds out there. And you're definitely one of them. So we appreciate everyone who's taken time to come on the show. It's been a lot of fun. And it's been honestly more rewarding than I can imagine. So thank you for being part of it. And we'll definitely keep an eye on your upcoming work. And feel free to come back anytime to chat about it.
Awesome. And the next time you're in Boca, let me know.
Oh, definitely will. Love the Boca West Palm Beach area. I will definitely give you a ring.
All right, Dan. Thanks so much. Take care.
Take care. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast and today's conversation with Classy's Michelle Boggs. I know that I learned a lot about why Americans give, and I hope that you did as well. And if you did get value out of our discussion, if it helped inspire some ideas, please subscribe to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever your favorite fundraising podcasts are heard. And if you'd like to take it to the next level, feel free to take 30 to 60 seconds to leave us an honest review and rate the show. It is the very best way to help boost our show in the rankings and help connect us with more fundraisers, as well as other great guests just like Michelle Boggs. And we are going to be having more great guests and more great content coming your way in the very near future. And I cannot wait to talk to you then. But until then, I am Dan Saunders reminding you that when we break down the walls of our industry and unsilo our minds, that's when we take fundraising to the next level. Talk to you soon.